ABC News, I'm Andy Field. Federal judge in Texas again ruling that the federal government's DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, is illegal. DACA lets immigrants brought to the U.S. illegally as children stay. An appeal to the Supreme Court is expected. White House offering a timeline on the administration's deal with Iran to free five detained Americans in exchange for unfreezing $6 billion in restricted oil revenue.
We expect in the coming days or so that that money will move ultimately to the final destination in Qatar.
State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller. For the first time in the United Auto Workers' history, the union could strike all big three automakers at once. UAW President Sean Fain telling members the latest offers are not enough.
The UAW doesn't back down from a fight. We're willing to do what's necessary to win justice by any means necessary.
This is ABC News. Federal judge agreeing to delay Joran Vandersloot's trial on extortion charges till later this year so his defense can have more time to prepare. He is the chief suspect in the 2005 disappearance of Natalie Holloway. Federal judge in Florida imposing a protective order in one of the cases against former President Trump.
The special counsel's case involving classified material stored at former President Trump's Palm Beach estate, the judge said, will require special security precautions. She set limits on who can see the material at issue and how. Violations, the judge said, may result in criminal and/or civil penalties. The order clears the way for the special counsel to begin turning over evidence to Trump's defense team. He has pleaded not guilty to charges he mishandled classified material and obstructed the government's efforts to get it back. Aaron Katursky, ABC News, New York.
Former New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson lying in state in Santa Fe. He died September 1st. He was 75. Funeral services tomorrow. Andy Field, ABC News.
Thanks for listening to your local Civic Media radio station. Learn more on our website, civicmedia.us.
For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly. Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers has rejected a surprise plan from Republicans in the state legislature that would have the legislature approve new maps drawn by nonpartisan staff. Governor Evers called the plan bogus, claiming it's a last-ditch effort for Republicans to control Wisconsin's electoral map. The bill states the maps could not be drawn to favor a party or incumbent legislator, but the nonpartisan staff would be chosen and approved by the legislature. According to a WUWM report, a new project from the Wisconsin Medical Society, Pharmacy Society of Wisconsin, and the Wisconsin Nurses Association is seeking to address racial disparities in healthcare for pregnant women. Nationwide data shows black women are three times more likely to die in childbirth and post-pregnancy and face much higher rates of postpartum depression. Medical professionals have cited inconsistencies in access to quality healthcare as a main cause and are seeking to address those issues through a pilot program and grant funding. For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly.
Red Delicious, Honey Crisp, Granny Smith. If you have a favorite apple, now is the time to pick it straight from the source. Did you know Wisconsin has more than 300 apple orchards? Travel Wisconsin recently naming its favorites, including the Oneida National Apple Orchard outside Green Bay, Ferguson's Orchards in Eau Claire, and Apple Holler south of Racine. Many provide tons of family fun in the fall, too. Tire swings, lawn bowling, hay rides, and more. Apple experts suggest if you want to pick yours fresh, do it before the end of October. For Civic Media, I'm Terry.
If I could be you.
And you could be me.
For just 1 hour.
If you could find a way.
To get inside.
Each other's mind.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
We've all felt left out. And for some, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here.
I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe, and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Protect your legacy. Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Love your hometown? Don't miss the Devil's Advocates radio show on the road for the very first Fall in Love Hometown Tour 2023.
But we're coming to a town near you all across the state of Wisconsin.
Mike and Dom kicking it all off in Wausau this Thursday starting at 4 p.m. Live from Bull Falls Radio, WXCO, 1230 AM, 98.9 FM.
Road trip! With the Devil's Advocates Fall in Love Hometown Tour 2023 on your local Civic Media radio station and the app. Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
Yeah. Todd Albo would normally be sharing his dulcet tones with us, but you'll recall that last week, Todd was having issues with the cable company, with an internet connection. I'm now thinking, Todd Albo, did you break Spectrum? Are you responsible for this ESPN mess?
I seem to have broke everything else, so it wouldn't surprise me, no.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow, weekday mornings 6 till 8, on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Missed your favorite show? It's easy to find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Apple, Google, or civicmedia.us. Looking for more local programming? Check out our website, civicmedia.us, to see our entire lineup.
Who questioned the effectiveness of lumping in potential allies with the fossil fuel industry and those responsible for delaying action. But in a press conference, new U.S. Open champion, 19-year-old Coco Gauff, whose semifinal match was interrupted, says she accepts climate science and sympathizes with their goals.
You know, I 100%, you know, believe in that. I think there's things that we can do better. The moments like this, yeah, are history-defining moments. And like I said, I prefer it not to happen in my match, but I wasn't pissed at, you know, the protesters. You know, I always speak about preaching about what you feel and what you believe in. And it was done in a peaceful way, so I can't get too mad at it.
Good for her. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to. Lots to talk about. Yesterday's conversation on the choices that we've made to double, more than double, child poverty caught a lot of attention. You know, a lot of email, a lot of response, and look, virtually all of it pointing out that it's disgraceful that in the wealthiest country in the history of civilization, at its wealthiest moment, we've got kids who go to bed hungry. What I'm thrilled and happy about is people are seeing that this was a choice, that we have made a decision. Our elected leaders made a choice, and look, we know who they are, and that's a good thing, because we can get rid of them. We can choose to send them packing, send them back to where they belong. I had someone today say to me that they really couldn't believe that the Republicans would fight feeding children. And I said, you know, what makes you think, given decades, literally decades of bad policy and showing us repeatedly that they don't care about children, they don't care about poverty, they don't care about working people, they care about the ultra wealthy, they care about tax cuts for the rich. That has been the MO for a very long time. And look, it's in their rhetoric. Tax cuts, smaller government. Drag it in a bathtub, drown it. I mean, it's who they are. And this is the thing that I'm still struggling with, because I think we're coming around to the reality that that Republicans hate working people. Look at all the things that they've done. But I don't think it's there yet, because I still think people want to believe that, you know, in their heart, you know, they really are, you know, somewhere deep down, really deep down, they're still decent. Because, you know, they tell us how religious they are. And yet you would think that the religious among us would be the ones going, hey, that guy we follow talked about feeding the hungry. In fact, did it. We should do that. But no. No. I mean, stop and think about the only accomplishment, legislative accomplishment, that happened during the 4 years of the Trump administration. And it was the tax cuts. In fact, Mitt Romney today talked about that. You know, Mitt Romney, who says he's not running for another term, you know, is now free to just come out and blast everything and said, look, you know, even that wasn't Trump's accomplishment. Even that wasn't the Republicans' accomplishment. It was Paul Ryan's. They have no policy. They have no platform. They have no vision for working people other than desperation. And I look at this and I go, you know, we chose, as a matter of policy, we chose to double, more than double, child poverty. That was a choice. Just like we could choose to end homelessness, we could choose to take care of our veterans, we could choose to do all of those things. We just don't. They're nice political issues we get to throw at each other, but as a matter of actually doing, we don't. And what we end up doing is we end up choosing desperation for some of our neighbors. And that's really what, you know, going and ending the child tax credit did. It was choosing the most vulnerable to be even more vulnerable, to be more desperate. And it comes back to this moment. And if you look around, you look at Iowa, you look at Arkansas, you look at a number of states across this country that are loosening child labor laws because, hey, we need cheap labor. We need to get those kids to work. You know, like the good old days. And you know, fortunately, no one this time came out and said, well, you're too hard on rich people, Rick. No, because I think we're finally waking up to the reality that the rich people, they only care about themselves for the most part. So when I played the clip of Tim Gerner, who, by the way, is worth more than $500 million, talking about we need to raise unemployment. We need to get those working people back into place. I had several people say, you know, you should play that clip again. In fact, you should play that clip often. And I got to tell you, I think I have to. So if you weren't here yesterday for Tim Gerner's his little spiel. Now, he's a real estate magnate from Australia, I believe. But this is his little song and dance.
I think the problem that we've had is that we have people decided they didn't really want to work so much anymore through COVID, and that has had a massive issue on productivity. You know, tradies have definitely pulled back on productivity. You know, they have been paid a lot to do not too much in the last few years. And we need to see that change. We need to see unemployment rise. Unemployment has to jump 40-50% in my view. We need to see pain in the economy. We need to remind people that they work for the employer, not the other way around. I mean, there's been a systematic change where employees feel the employer is extremely lucky to have them, as opposed to the other way around. So it's a dynamic that has to change. We've got to kill that attitude, and that has to come through hurting the economy, which is what the whole global, you know, the world is trying to do. The governments around the world are trying to increase unemployment to get that to some sort of normality. And we're seeing it. I think every employer now is seeing it. I mean, there is definitely massive layoffs going off. People might not be talking about it, but people are definitely laying people off, and we're starting to see less arrogance in the employment market, and that has to continue because that will cascade across the cost balance.
Now, we most certainly have to have you know, those people back in line. And you hear what he said? Governments are pushing for this. And he's right. We have a branch of our government doing just that. The Republicans have been trying to push for recession. They've been trying to starve the economy. They've been trying to push exactly what this guy's talking about. We got a Federal Reserve who's hell-bent on slamming on the brakes so that we do what? More unemployment. So that wages don't go up, because heaven forbid that happen. And I have to there's so much here. This is one of those moments where you go, he's honest. He's at least on that front. He's honest. He's telling the truth. This is the view that he has of working people. And this is the view that the very wealthy have always had. You know, I remember doing research, you know, years ago when I was in college, because, you know, labor was part of my focus going through college. And I wrote a piece on child labor. And one of the, there was a CEO back in the 1910s, who said that, you know, education is spoiled on children because it spoils them for work. If they get too much education, they won't want to work. And, you know, we need hand laborers, we need factory workers, we need grunts, we need, you know, too much education will, you know, destroy a workforce. And that attitude has not changed. It's just they don't say it out loud anymore. There's no more the quote attributed to Jay Gould, "I can pay half the working class to murder the other half." They don't say that anymore. But it's what they know, because it's what they do, and it's what they do very effectively. And as I was going through the emails today, and as I was responding, and I was thinking about, you know, where we are. We're at a place right now where, understand, policymakers in these red states, the welfare states, the states that are living off of the government dole, who take more money from the federal government than they pay in, and then saying we need to destroy social programs and destroy food stamp programs because, you know, we need them hungry enough to go back to work. These are the ones pushing these child labor bills. Because again, we need a flood of cheap labor to get back into the workforce. And this is the weird thing. And we're in a weird moment because corporate America, you know, they want immigration so that they can abuse cheap labor. And Republicans used to be on board with that. It's just now such a political football that we're going to sacrifice our children. This is what they're telling us. That they, at all costs, were going to get cheap labor. Because they don't care about us. You know, I was remembering, you know, during COVID, you know, one of the meatpacking plants that, you know, they were out there, you know, betting on, you know, how many people they could get sick. They were out there betting on how many people would get COVID and how many of them would die and, you know, all this. Because they don't care about working people. And this is where, in this moment right now, we have got to organize and come together and fight for permanence. And this is where you know, we a guest yesterday said, you know, Biden should be pushing for a higher minimum wage. Absolutely. But more importantly, we should be fighting for stronger laws to allow people to fight for better wages, hours, working conditions. Because understand, the people who sit in our boardrooms are the Tim Gerners of the world. And while your American CEOs aren't going to go out and say that in public, it's what they say in the dark. It's what they say to each other. It's the policies they push. Just look at the contract fights that have been going on. So are you surprised that a very wealthy guy would say, you know what? We need 50% more unemployment. We need desperation. We need pain. We need to get those people back into line. Are you surprised by it? Shouldn't be. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back.
We We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So Donald Trump has fully embraced Putin's sympathetic comments. You remember yesterday we talked a little bit about Putin coming out and saying, what's happening with Trump is a persecution of a political rival for political motives. Putin says this shows the whole rottenness of the American system, which cannot claim to teach others about democracy. Now, again, as I said yesterday, this is a guy who, poisons his political opponents. Think of the polonium 210T cocktail he served up. And this is a guy who's, reportedly, thrown journalists out of windows, turned a certain mercenary into a lawn dart. To have him, on your side, there used to be a time where you didn't embrace that. Not Trump, man. Someone said something nice about him. Someone said something nice about him. So he's got to embrace it. Even if it is a murderous dictator. What do you expect? What do you expect? Let's go to the phones. Got Alice on one. Alice, how are you?
Insane.
What's...
Okay. So, anyone who is embracing the idea that having Vladimir Putin on one side has totally lost their plot and jumped the shark. And, it's amazing. We have them here in the United States, and they're in the Republican Party. And in Russia, he is not even Russian. He is Georgian by birth. He was adopted. And he has been doing in, I guess, that has been brought up lately, and he has been doing in those who have been bringing it up. They've unfortunately, fallen out of windows. Darn, so many people over there fall out of windows. They need to put bars on the windows. And, drop down, drop
or
dead.
Or nets.
Yeah, a net, something.
Like they do in China to keep the people from killing themselves at the factories.
Exactly. So, and you were saying about the Republicans. They have never cared about the working class. My dad was born in 1908, passed away in 1992. And my dad was a lifetime Democrat, and he always said to everyone, because he was involved in local politics, and he would say to everyone, do you actually think that the Republican Party cares about you? Look at what they're doing. And I'm saying this 30-some years later after his death. Do you really think the Republican Party cares about you? Look at what they're doing. But, they're all alike. We have... Here in our little hamlet, we have five council members, and four of them are Republicans, because we're a Republican town. But now that they've gotten on the council, and they're trying to make, we have pretensions to being a homeowners association, apparently, our little population of 230 people, and they're trying to pass all these most ridiculous ordinances you've ever heard of in your life, So I've got a bullseye on my back because I went to the last meeting, and I even said that, and I said, you know, you're supposed to be serving the people, not your own agenda. It's not your town. You're not a king or queen. You're a public servant, you know, and I just ran my mouth. So
I can see that.
But it doesn't matter. They're all alike. Yeah. You know, I don't care if it's, you know, the person on the local council or the dog man, or they're in the Senate or the House of Representatives. They're all alike. So go. People better wake up and smell the coffee. But have a good evening.
Amen. Appreciate it. Thank you, Alice. You know, and what happened to smaller, less intrusive government? What happened to less intrusive government? Jeez. But here's the thing. You know, if Vivek Ramaswamy, if he gets his way, evidently Ramaswamy is trying to out-Trump Trump. He said that he's going to cut 75% of the federal workforce and shutter several major. Again, as I said, you know, small enough that you can drag government into the bathtub and drown the bathtub. That's always been their goal. And who do you think they're going to go after? You know, Trump wants to do away with the Department of Education, and they've been wanting to do that for a long time. You know, where do you think, you know, Health and Human Services? What do you think goes? Where do you think their values are? Who do you think they take out? You know, anything that's going to benefit you and your family. And I find it ironic that you know, again, trying to out Trump Trump, given the fact that the Heritage Foundation has come up with their Project 2025 scheme, which is to bring patronage back. And a big part of that is to go and fire all the federal workers and, you know, have people who are already vetted in the pipeline. So basically what they're talking about doing, what their plot is to do what the Federalist Society has done for judges. You groom them very young, you get them into low-level jobs, and you bring them along into your ideological viewpoints. And then when the big jobs come up, you've already got them in place. They're already trained. You know everything that they're going to do before they know what to do. They want to do this for every job of the federal government. Stop and think about the level of control that they're talking about. This authoritarian mindset that you have to be faithful to dear leader and to our dear ideology, or you don't work for the federal government. And me, I keep saying I want boring bureaucrats. I want people who are competent. I want people who show up every day, do their job, and do the best job they can for we the people, without a political agenda. These folks, they want to use every lever of government for politics to move their agenda. And what's their agenda? Well, more for them and less for everybody else. So are we surprised by this? The answer, no, not even a little bit. Now, the big news today, obviously, Mitt Romney not running for another Senate term. And I find it interesting that, you know, now Romney comes out and says, look, you know, the Republicans, they don't care about the Constitution. They don't care. They don't really care about any of the stuff that they throw out here. And in his exit interview, the big thing that's getting the attention right now is the comment, the tweet or the text that he sent to Mitch McConnell, which is, you know, he evidently got a call from Angus Young. He said he spoke with people at the Pentagon. Hey, on January 6th, you know, some bad stuff's about to happen. Maybe you might want to, oh, I don't know, do something. Because, hey, Mitch, they're talking about burning your house down. Maybe you do something. McConnell never responded. And, you know, there's a moment where I go, you know, there's an opportunity for Mitch, for Mitt Romney to come out and really just expose all of the insanity. And I'm hoping he does. My problem is he's going to do it in a both sidesism way, because this is what people do these days. You know, Trump's really bad, but we've got to figure out something for Biden too, because we don't want to make it look like we're partisan. No, when the house is on fire, you put out the fire. And right now, the fire is Donald Trump. Right now, the fire is the Republican Party, who have no agenda whatsoever. I got to come back to this time and time again. There's nothing there. And even Romney said it. He said, do you remember when Trump said we were going to get health care? and it was going to be great. It was going to be cheap. It was going to be affordable. It was going to be amazing. It was going to be the best thing ever. You remember that? And we never saw anything. This is what he was talking about. He said, look, they've got no agenda. The Republicans have no policies. And I love the fact that, you know, Mike Simpson, Republican from Idaho, is now saying it's going to be a giant S show, you know, as the coming days come down to the wire over the debt and the debt ceiling and the spending. And he says, look, we're in trouble. We're in big trouble because there's no leadership. And the Republican Party is off the rails because they want their pound of flesh. You've got the Scott Perrys of the world who desperately, desperately want a shutdown. Because this works a couple of ways for them. It helps slow the economy. It's going to hurt the economy. It's going to get them the recession, possibly, that they've been, you know, having, you know, tingly feelings all over. And it's going to hurt working people. Especially federal workers, who they particularly hate. And my mind keeps going to this place. When do we finally wake up? When do we finally start throwing these bums to the curb and say, find us some people who actually care about people. Find us some folks who actually care about moving some policy that's going to make working people's lives better. Is that too much to ask? Could be. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1934. That was the day Rhode Island Governor Theodore Green demanded that federal troops be sent to crush a textile strike in his state. The general textile strike, then in its second week, stretched across the Piedmont from New England to Georgia. Green declared, quote, "We are face to face not with a textile strike, but with a communist uprising." His demands came after days of pitched battles between thousands of strikers and the Rhode Island National Guard in Salesville and Woonsocket. Secretary of War George Dern assured the governor and the press that 3,000 combat troops were ready and available for immediate duty in Rhode Island. President Franklin Roosevelt declined to send in federal troops, but the state assembly authorized the governor to close the mills and appropriated $100,000 in funds to beef up state police forces. The governor then directed Rhode Island's police chiefs to round up all communists on charges of inciting riots in textile centers across the state. It gave local authorities the pretext to round up and arrest over 200 alleged agitators, strike leaders, militants, and radicals. Over the course of 4 days, 3 strikers had been killed, including Charles Gorsinski at Salesville and Jude Cordomenci at Woonsocket. Hundreds had been seriously injured in the 2 cities. 7 of the 16 strikers who had been shot by state troops were near death. State National Guardsmen had been given the shoot-to-kill order to protect the mills and the scabs. Once the governor shut down the mills, police forces easily arrested dozens of flying squadron picketers and established martial law-like conditions, though it was never officially established. Within days, the strike would be quelled in Rhode Island.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Last week, I talked about how Labor Day was created in the 1880s by rebellious workers. But I'm celebrating the spirit again this week because a momentous new energy has been building in today's union movement. Indeed, renewed union rebelliousness has put labor back in Labor Day. Previously cast as a day off, it's now a day on, rallying working-class activism and celebrating nationwide strikes by such disparate groups as Teamsters and Hollywood actors. This is making the corporate bosses very antsy, for it's the harbinger of a new order that is undermining absolutist boss rule. Particularly alarming to the plutocratic establishment is the new aggressiveness of the United Auto Workers Union under their recently elected grassroots president, Sean Fain. Tossing aside the old willingness to accept incremental changes in contract negotiations, Fain began the current bargaining round by literally throwing the industry's proposal in the wastebasket, bluntly declaring that's where it belongs. Such honesty has spooked Detroit's auto barons, who are wailing that the workers' demands are, quote, excessive. This from pampered CEOs, each pocketing between $20 and $34 million a year in personal pay. Pathetically, the corporate establishment has no better retort to feign than to try its tired old Red Scare bugaboo. This man studied Trotsky, squealed one squeamish corporatist on TV. No, instead, Sean Fain has clearly studied Walter Reuther, Mother Jones, Fighting Bob La Follette, Frederick Douglass, Cesar Chavez, and other American champions of economic fairness and social justice. This is Jim Hightower saying, the big story here is not that a president of one workers' organization is shaking things up, but that organized workers themselves are on the move, demanding economic democracy.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I found out that Drew Barrymore has a talk show. I didn't know that. I thought she was a movie actress, and you know, I always loved her movies and all that. I found out she's actually the host of a talk show, and I wish I would have found out under better circumstances, because evidently it's been a couple of years that she's been doing this. But I find out that she has this talk show because she's scabbing on the Writers Guild. And you go, why would you be doing this? Why would you want this kind of attention in this moment when all the country, all the working people, their eyes are on this? Why would you want to be the most visible, the most famous scab in the country? Makes no sense to me. But here to share some thoughts on Maybe there's an answer here that I'm not getting. I've asked David Slack to come talk with us. He's a TV writer, producer, former WGA West board member, also a guy who very active on Twitter, which is how I found his thread. David, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Rick.
So walk me through this. Why?
Well, why you'd have to ask Drew Barrymore? There are a lot of things we could speculate, but it's a complicated situation because so everybody knows the WGA is on strike. Everybody knows SAG-AFTRA is on strike. But beyond that, it gets into the nuance of, you know, how labor unions work, because SAG-AFTRA has multiple bargaining units. Talk shows, daytime talk shows, soap operas, game shows are covered under a contract called Netcode, and that contract is not on strike. So to be clear, Drew Barrymore is not scabbing against SAG-AFTRA right by going on her show right now. That contract is totally fine. The problem is her show is WGA covered. Her show, since its inception, has employed WGA writers who are currently out walking a picket line. And by going back on the air, it is very hard to believe that someone isn't performing work that was previously done by striking workers. And you know what we call a person who does work that's performed by striking workers? That's a scab. In the case of Drew Barrymore, and by the way, she's not alone. The people on The View, which is also WGA covered and has been since its inception, they've been scabbing this entire time. The Talk is about to come back. The Jennifer Hudson Show is back. Bill Maher is about to come back. So there are a lot of people in this situation. What's been so disappointing about Drew Barrymore is a couple of things. One, she's already shown a willingness to not cross our picket lines. She refused to go on to host the MTV Movie Awards early in our strike and stood in solidarity with us. So this is somebody who really showed that she was comfortable and confident in breaking contracts for the sake of the collective good, for the sake of standing in solidarity with labor. And now she's flipped on that. But she also put out a public statement that erroneously said that she wasn't breaking any WGA rules, which is just not true. It is very hard to imagine that anyone on a show that normally employs writers, and trust me, the TV show would not have writers if they didn't need them. They don't pay for anything they don't need. They try not to pay for things they do need. But so it's very hard to believe that they could, that a show that normally needs writers can be done without those writers present, without somebody scabbing on those jobs. So, and you know, she decided to become the main character. I don't know why.
No, and this is one of those moments, you know, I tell the story often. When my mother passed, I moved in with my grandparents. And my grandfather said, you don't go across the street and you don't play with that guy's grandkids. You don't go anywhere over there. And I never knew why. And I asked him a couple years later and I said, you know, what was that all about? And he said, the guy had crossed a picket line like 40 years before. It was a railroad picket. And the entire community ostracized the guy and the entire family. And this is where I'm looking at this moment going, as a society, we should be holding these scabs accountable in public, especially someone as high profile as Drew Barrymore. This is one of those things where the message that's being sent is all the wrong messages, or at least I think so. I'm curious your thoughts.
I completely agree. I mean, and you can say, oh, she didn't understand, she was misinformed. That's fine. She's now been correctly informed and has a chance to make this right by stopping doing her show. You know, you can say, well, she cares about her crew and wants to put them back to work, you know, but the fact is by going back to work with scab labor while we're still on strike, she may be putting her crew back to work, but she's providing the studios we're on strike against with content, which prolongs the strike. So her crew may be working, but every other crew in Hollywood, it might be out of work that much longer because of what she's doing. And that's really hurtful because it's not just, you know, strikes are hard on everybody. And it's not just writers and actors on strike who are hurting. There are IATSE crew members and Teamster truck drivers and all these other businesses in LA and New York and other markets that depend on the entertainment industry. You know, the California economy is losing about $30 million a day because, you know, Bob Iger and David Zaslav and another couple of billionaire CEOs can't admit that they've already lost. Yeah. And it's time to sit down and make a deal.
No, you know, we started the show off, you know, playing a quote from a rich guy saying, you know, we need to cause more unemployment so that, you know, those working people, you know, they get desperate again and they're back in their place. And you're part of that. I mean, the writers are part of this. You know, you've got the very wealthy who could easily afford all of your demands and all of your requests easily. It would not cost them very much at all, but it's the point. It's the point that they control you and that you should be grateful for having a job and that you should be in your place. And I see this more as that than it is about the money or about fighting over AI or any of that other stuff. Do you agree?
I think there's absolutely an element of class warfare. I think for the CEOs, I think this is like if you owned a paper mill and all of a sudden the trees started trying to tell you how many that you could pulp and turn into paper. I think it's inconceivable to them. And, you know, one thing that's tricky for us in, you know, with both actors and writers, we have some members who have done very, very well. You know, there are people who get fabulously wealthy and Drew Barrymore is one of them. Yeah. She's worth many millions of dollars. And so the public's perception sometimes is that, well, what are you on strike for? You're all millionaires. But the fact is we are labor. We do not decide how much we get paid. We negotiate hard over how much we get paid, but it's ultimately what the bosses will allow. And, you know, the Writers Guild of America is a middle class union. Most of our members do not make the fabulous money. We're on strike. You know, it's crazy. We struck for 100 days in 2007, 2008 to get coverage over the internet, the entire internet. Took 100 days. And if we hadn't done that, every single streaming show out there would be a non-union show, not just for writers, but for actors, for directors, for crews, for truck drivers. You know, now we're on strike for, this was day 135. So longer than it took to get the internet. And what are we on strike for? Fair pay, a cost of living raise. We had 2 years of 6% plus inflation. And these guys are trying to turn that inflation into an upside for them by limiting our pay raise and stopping us from getting basic protections against things like AI and against free rewrites. You know, it's just, it is very much an element of class warfare. You know, it is very much that at the end of the day, these guys who, you know, David Zaslav gets about $250 million a year, you know, just like two Zaslavs could cover everything the WGA is asking for 3 years. And he's already lost his company $300 to $500 million. The WGA's entire ask per year from his company is $47 million. So collectively, these guys are losing billions to maybe save millions. And you got to ask yourself, why are they doing that?
Well, I go back to what I said a moment ago. It's all about control. It's all about, we're going to keep you in your place and you're going to do what you're told and you're going to be happy about it.
Yeah, and it sure as hell looks to me like they're violating their fiduciary duty to their shareholders over this stuff. And, you know, you look at some of the companies we're on strike against are Netflix, Apple, Amazon. You know, we've got tech companies. And for them, I think they don't want their other employees to know that a union can beat them. Because that's, you know, if we beat them, how's that look to Amazon warehouse workers or the people who work at Apple stores or the coders at Netflix? All of these are, you know, largely non-union jobs that are ripe for unionization and in the most positive environment for labor organizing that we've seen, you know, in maybe 60 years. So, you know, I think they very much want us to lose. But the fact is, we're 135 days into this and our solidarity is rock solid. We had a picket of showrunners. Those are, you know, the writers who run television shows, who generally do very well. And there's not actually much at stake for a lot of them in this negotiation. We had, I think, about 400 show up at the Fox lot. It was so crowded, you could barely walk. And they donated collectively in various forms with gift cards and Venmo and stuff. They donated about $40,000 to help our members get through this. So our solidarity is unbroken. It's just time for them to sit down and make a deal. And, you know, the only reason I think that they won't is they can't get on the same page with each other because they're competitors. And I think it just rankles. I think they just don't want to accept that a little union of ordinary people could bring them to their knees.
You know, as you were talking, I was thinking about an old timer I knew years ago who said, you know, every 10 years he used to take his union on strike just because it built this solidarity, just because it built relationships with other unions and showed working people that they could fight for something and win something. And once you grab onto it, once you win something, you never give it up. And that was the, you know, that's what I'm seeing happening as all of these, you know, the Teamsters with the UPS, the UAW going on right now, you guys out there, it's this sense of we're fighting the good fight. We're fighting for tomorrow. And that's got to scare the you know what out of some.
Oh, it should. They should be really scared. I mean, one of my personal heroes is Sarah Nelson, who's the head of the Association of Flight Attendants. And she says this wonderful thing, using power builds power.
Yep.
When we use our power, when we recognize our own power and use it, when we stand together, we actually get stronger. And, you know, the WGA, there's 11,500 of us, you know, we're not necessarily the most physically intimidating crowd, although some of us are, you know, but, you know, you like, you look at the Teamsters and it's a different vibe, right? But we have organized ourselves. We held together through a 2.5 year campaign to renegotiate the way that our agents were doing business. We changed their business practices. We got them to give up a conflicted business practice. And we actually got two private equity firms signed to union deals, which I'm not sure has happened before. Wow. And then we used that power. We had to renegotiate our last contract in 2020 in May, in the height of the pandemic. So our leverage is gone, right? Like, what are we going to do? Go on strike? Everything's shut down. But because of the power that we had built by how we dealt with the agencies and how we held together then, we were able to get the money we needed into our pension plan and win a portable paid parental leave benefit that lets our members take paid parental leave regardless of which studio they're working for at the time with no leverage. With, you know, what were we going to do? Strike? But we still got it. So using power builds power, and recognizing your power and talking to your other members about it is so essential.
Let me ask you this, David, because, you know, one of the things that I've been saying about what you and the SAG-AFTRA folks are striking for, and I've been saying this is the first battle in the AI war, in the tech war. This is the first, really the first battle in this war that the reason that all of us should be concerned about what happens to you, and why I've been calling for people to adopt a striker when they find a picket line, go walk with someone, bring, you know, water, bring a pizza, you know, drop a couple bucks in the donation bin, help how you can, but most certainly get involved. But this matters to all of us, because if you're unable to stop what we see coming, the rest of us are, I think, doomed. Do you see it kind of the same way?
Yeah, no, I mean, AI is an interesting issue for us because I thought it was going to be like something we just needed to square away because our contract has said for years that a writer is a person. So I thought this was pro forma, and it was surprising to a lot of us when our negotiating partners in the AMPTP said, well, we're not going to make any sort of deal on that because we don't want to rule out a technology we may want to use someday. And that was rather shocking to us. There's not much that they can do with it now. There are some, you know, contractual loophole things they could use it, but ChatGPT is not ready to do what I do. And I frankly think that it'll be able to do a CEO's job a long time before it can do mine. That's just an optimization algorithm. If mine, you have to understand the human soul and the human experience. You know, a chat algorithm can't write about its mother dying because it never had one. Now, with SAG-AFTRA, though, with the actors, this is already existential for them. They're already having background people get paid one day's wages to get a full body scan so that they can use them as digital background in perpetuity throughout the universe and all media now existing or hereafter devised. A friend of mine who's an audiobook narrator has already had her voice stolen twice by two separate AI companies. And when she tries to make claims on that, they're like, you can't copyright your own voice. And I think you're absolutely right, though, that these are, you know, oh, that just concerns you. But the fact is, this is coming for all of us. It's coming for lawyers. It's coming for doctors. It's certainly coming for CPAs. You know, anything that is knowledge work is suddenly vulnerable. And it's not enormously different, by the way, than the mechanization, the automation of auto factories, you know, 40 years ago. So I think we're at a point where we as a society are going to have to choose between two possible futures. One in which humans have jobs and we have a reason to get out of bed in the morning and something to feel proud about and a way to make money and support ourselves and our family and our society functions. Or another future where two or three people have an enormous amount of money. The rest of us are on some sort of universal basic income or welfare. And we have a bloody revolution every 10 to 15 years. And that changes who the two or three people with all the money are. I know which one I want. I think there's two or three people out there who think they might get to be the lucky guy with all the money. But I think we fundamentally have to choose. And I think you're absolutely right. And a lot of those other crafts and trades that AI is coming for aren't unionized. So, you know, when they come for lawmakers, I think we'll get some legislation pretty quickly.
Well, there you go. Last question I've got for you. How can folks help? What can we do? Because, look, this is gone on far too long already. You know, how can we put pressure on the Drew Barrymores of the world to not scab? And you listed a number of other folks. How do we put pressure on them? What's the marching order?
Well, I mean, thank you so much for asking. I love the adopt a striker. It's certainly putting pressure on people who are scabbing Drew Barrymore, the cast of The View, you know, shows like The Talk. Just to be clear, news programs, different contract. That's not WGA, and The View is not a news program. If anybody has questions about what shows are and aren't covered, they can go direct to directories.wga.org, and you type in the show title, and you'll see if it's WGA covered. But as far as other ways to help, there are some great resources here. And as I said, it's not just writers and actors who are feeling this. It's everybody in our industry. So there's something called the Entertainment Community Fund. That's at entertainmentcommunityfund.org. And people can go there and donate. And they are providing enormous amounts of support, both financial and services. Like they'll help people find healthcare if their healthcare expires. There's psychological counseling. There's financial counseling. So the Entertainment Community Fund is one that I would, you know, definitely recommend. There's also a wonderful person who's a longtime friend of mine named Joel Garfinkel, who you can find on Twitter, Joel Garfinkel. She's doing something called Green Envelope Groceries. That's a mutual aid thing. She's taken in $175,000 in donations so far and redistributed them at no cost to people who are affected by the strike to help them just keep food on the table. So, but yeah, spread the word, let people know that, you know, this is important and, you know, scabbing makes it all take longer. And like you said, it's already gone on too long. I really appreciate it.
I hope folks will help out because the more people we can get involved, the more people who get out on that picket line, the more people who are donating, the shorter this strike will be. But David, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
I'd love that. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, David Slack. I got to tell you, this is another one of those moments where you just go, if all of us just came together, get out on those picket lines, this kind of stuff wouldn't have to happen all like this. I want to hear your thoughts, though. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back. Stick around.
Phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1971. That was the day that the state police stormed Attica Correctional Facility in New York. 4 days earlier, the inmates had taken over the prison. One guard was killed. The guards were members of AFSCME Council 82. The prisoners demanded improvements to their brutal living conditions in the overcrowded prison. Police retook most of the prison, but the inmates held guards hostage in cell block D. One of the prisoners, Elliot James Barkley, explained the takeover. "We are men. We are not beasts, and we do not depend to be beaten or driven as such. The entire prison populace, that means each and every one of us here, have set forth to change forever the ruthless brutalization and disrespect for the lives of the prisoners here and throughout the United States." When the police stormed the prison, they dropped tear gas from helicopters. They fired 3,000 rounds, firing on prisoners and hostages indiscriminately. They killed 29 inmates and 10 hostages. Police claimed the prisoners had killed the hostages. They also accused the inmates of committing atrocities against the guards. Public outrage swelled against the inmates, including racially charged hate directed at the black prisoners. But autopsies proved that all of those killed had been felled by police bullets. Attica became the rallying cry for those concerned about prison conditions. It has been referenced by many in movies and songs, including John Lennon's Attica State. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So, I gotta tell you, I'm not a Swiftie. I love some of the stuff she's done. I've never really gotten into the music as much. I've seen her in concert once. Took my wife years ago to see Taylor Swift when we were in Cleveland. But I gotta tell you, I love who she is. Taking on Ticketmaster, and now this story coming out of, this is how it should be. She has this the Eras Tour film coming out, and she bypassed the big studios. In fact, as it's been called a giant middle finger to the Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers, because Taylor Swift said, you know what, I'm not going to go through the major studios, I'm going to self-distribute this, to AMC and distribute it ourselves. So she went to SAG-AFTRA and said, hey, folks, want a contract, and basically gave them everything that they needed. And there will be this film coming out. And it's this is the kind of person that I got to tell you, I thought Drew Barrymore was. This is not a person who needs the money. It's my view that these shows, with these extraordinarily well-paid hosts should be paying their staff to keep them around. During this strike should be helping them. And there are some, there are a number that are doing that. But to have someone, say, you know what, we're gonna screw you. I'm gonna say this right now. I will never watch a Drew Barrymore show. And this is where, as a society, you need to turn away from these people. Because understand, while it's in our media structure, it's framed as, these writers, they're making all this money, they're wealthy, they just want more, they're greedy. You hear this about unions all the time. They're just greedy, they just want more. Without actually understanding that when they do better, we all do better. when they get better wages, hours, conditions, it trickles down to everyone else. You go back to the good old days, the heyday of the labor movement, you know, back in the 60s when 35% of the private sector workforce was unionized. 35% of the other side, the non-union sector, made virtually the same wages, hours, conditions because they didn't want the union to come into those places. So everyone did better. And what's happened since then? As we've, you know, thank you, Ronald Reagan, firing the Patco workers, sending the shot across the boardroom that it was open season on unions and workers. What's happened since that moment?
You're listening to WLAK 1260 AM Amory and WBZH 910 AM W245 CT Hayward. Always streaming on the Civic
ABC
Media
News.
App.
I'm in.